case number 57934. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Welcome back, Mr. Moloff. Please come forward and let us know how much time you want to reserve.
I'd like to reserve 7 minutes. Good morning. Lee Moloff, appearing on behalf of the appellant, John Schleining. The issue this morning before the court is this. Under what set of circumstances, if any, can the concept, the three concepts of substantial compliance, actual notice, and lack of prejudice substitute for strict compliance with the statutory notice requirements set forth in NRS 107080 and 107095 relating to guarantors and the protections to guarantors under a non-judicial deed of trust foreclosure? Sections 107080 and 107095, read together, set forth a mandatory requirement. The statute in 095 uses the term must, that the notice of default and election to sell that is given to a borrower at the beginning of a foreclosure process must be sent by registered or certified mail to the guarantor at least 15 days prior to the expiration of the 35-day cure period, which is initiated by the recording of the notice of default.
And Mr. Moloff, I know that didn't happen. I guess my concern, looking at Judge Pillaw's ruling, is when did the guarantor find out about this? How much before the trustee's sale? And was that a reasonable period of time to respond to it? And I'm just curious of your thoughts on those points.
Well, it's undisputed in the record that the guarantor, Mr. Schleining, the appellant, my client, did not find out about the foreclosure proceeding at all until 2 or 3 days prior to the actual sale. Mm-hmm. Under the statute, he should have been given approximately 91 days notice before the foreclosure sale could actually occur. Mm-hmm. He was shorted 89 days of that 91 days that the statute requires. The district court made its ruling here. The district court decided that in this case, substantial compliance would be a substitute for the actual compliant. And that's what this court has to decide, whether what the district court did is acceptable. And our position is it's not acceptable at all. The district court ruled that the concept of substantial compliance, taken together with the concept of actual notice, taken together with the concept of lack of prejudice, can work as a substitute for strict compliance with the statute. The statute is clear. You have to send notice to the guarantor at least 15 days prior to the expiration of the cure period. That didn't occur here. There was no notice sent. There's not a question. It's undisputed. It was admitted at trial that there was no notice sent to the guarantor, addressed to the guarantor, or given to the guarantor in any manner whatsoever. Mr. Schleining only learned of the foreclosure 2 or 3 days prior to the actual conduct of the sale. The district court ruled that the district court felt that it apparently felt that it had some discretion to determine as a question of fact whether or not this was prejudicial. But the statute itself sets forth what is prejudicial and what's not prejudicial. If you don't give notice, that's prejudice. And notice was not given here. Substantial compliance is all over cases in Nevada. Nevada law has defined substantial compliance. Here we're talking about substantial compliance with a specific provision in a statute to give notice.
Mr. Mull, I think, and I understand, we had a foreclosure mediation case recently where a lender was supposed to produce certain documents, and they didn't. It was kind of, but the borrower did have the document, you know, for the mediation, and I know we concluded that was sufficient to comply with the notice because they didn't have the prejudice there. I don't know if that even applies to this case because this is a different situation and all, but that scenario went through my mind in trying to analyze this case.
And I don't know if it's analogous either. I'm not directly familiar with that case. But what the law in Nevada is, what the cases do stand for, is this proposition, that the objectives and requirements of the statute have been fulfilled substantially. It's not rocket scientists. One need not be a great legal scholar to understand what substantial compliance means. If a statute is passed by the legislature has certain objectives behind that statute, and to fulfill those objectives substantially is what substantial compliance is.
Counsel, am I reading the record incorrectly that the guarantee in this case also included a waiver of the right to receive notice by your client?
Yes, and I will get to that waiver argument, Your Honor. Under Section 40.453, one cannot waive those types of requirements. And that actually is the respondent's position, because the district court actually ruled in our favor on that position, and I will be more than happy to address the entire waiver issue as part of my rebuttal argument or later in my direct argument here. But substantial compliance could be, for example, a technical defect where the name of the guarantor or the name of the recipient of the notice is misspelled, where some fact contained within the notice, within the content of the notice of default, misstates something. But as long as it's sent, that can be, as long as it's sent within the 15 days prior to the expiration of the cure period, that would be a requirement of substantial compliance. And in this case, that was not done. Actually,
the way I read Judge Palaha's order is that he seems to say that actual notice substitutes for substantial or for the transmission of the notice in the first place. And why wouldn't actual notice suffice?
Actual notice can suffice under the law, under the cases in Nevada, as long as the actual notice is learned, the knowledge of the person who's supposed to get that notice is gained, the knowledge is learned, within the same time periods that notice and knowledge would be gained if formal notice had been given under
the statute. But Judge Palaha goes to some extent in his findings, pointing out the relationship between your client and, is it DeKal? Is that the right spelling of the company?
DeKal Nevada.
Yes. Yeah. As to demonstrate that he acquired this actual notice much earlier than 3 days before the sale by virtue of his relationship with that company.
Well, I'd respond to your point with 2 points. Number one, the statute doesn't allow...
I'm not trying to make a point. I'm just observing that that's what the judge's findings say.
Sure. The statute requires that notice be given to the guarantor, whether or not the guarantor is related or associated with the borrower at all. In almost all cases, I'm sure, in almost all circumstances, the guarantor is going to have some relation with the borrower. And just because the borrower gets notice under 107.080, that doesn't obviate the need for the lender to give notice under 107.095.
Well, but you're indicating that, let me just ask this question. Is actual notice of the foreclosure by your client sufficient to satisfy the requirements of the statute?
Not unless it's given 91 days prior to the foreclosure sale.
But you so do.
If it were given 91 days, as long, you would say that actual notice satisfies the requirements of the statute.
As long as the other elements of substantial compliance, the other objectives of that statute are met. The other objectives of the 107.080 are not only to give some notice that there's this foreclosure proceeding, but to specifically identify the nature of the default, and there's a number of other pieces of information that are to be contained, that are to be received. But from a timing standpoint, assuming the other elements are met in terms of substantially meeting the objectives, I would agree.
Was there any dispute that the notice given to the borrower was defective in any respect?
No, there's no dispute. The borrower did receive notice properly under 107.080,
okay,
and so forth. And I think
I want to clarify one point on Justice Hardesty's. So your position is that under 107.095, as written at the time pertinent to your case, although the statute seems to say the notice must be sent by registered or certified mail to each guarantor, and that failure to give the notice, except as specified in subsection 3, releases the guarantor, you're saying that actual notice could substitute for that despite the statute's express wording. you agree with that under existing Nevada law?
Yes. Under existing Nevada law, there is the concept of substantial compliance, and substantial compliance can be met if the timing is done right and the other objectives of the statute are otherwise substantially met.
And you agree with that reading of 095 applying it to that?
Yes. And I would like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Paul Georgeson appearing on behalf of the respondents in this matter, which is Cap One, Inc., the DeMonte Family Trust, the DiLoreto Family Trust, and the Prim Family Trust, whom I will refer to as the lenders in this case. Before this Court, Mr. Schleining argues, as he did before the District Court, that he is absolved from his contractual guarantee obligations because the written notice of default and election to sell, which was recorded, which was published, which was sent to the specific address identified in his guarantee as his address for notices, to an office building that he owned, to a company that he was the sole remaining responsible party for, that because the envelope on that letter didn't have his name on it, it only had his company's name on it, then he is absolved from responsibility for his personal responsibilities.
Yeah, Mr. Georgeson, the guarantors are individuals generally. It can be corporate entities, and there's a whole set of rules on guarantors and how to notice them. And this notice issue here, I think, is due process. It can't be waived. You know, you got to give the proper note, at least my view of it. The question is, my only concern is if he had actual notice that Justice Hardesty raised, maybe that's enough here. But I think you're kind of just blowing this off like it's meaningless, and the statutes are very specific on guarantor. You want to go after guarantor, you better dot the I's and cross the T's, and you didn't here. So explain to us why Palaha made the correct decision here, in your view.
Your Honor, he made the correct decision for two reasons. First, he made the correct decision that substantial compliance doctrine that has been adopted by this Court in notice-type statutes applies to these statutes. And second, once he adopted the substantial compliance doctrine and then looked at the safeguards that this Court has identified, the actual knowledge, the lack of prejudice and substantial compliance, he made factual determinations that those factual issues were satisfied. Now, if I may address substantial compliance doctrine briefly.
Before you do that,
yes,
though, Mr. Moloff stated that it's undisputed that his client did not get actual notice until 2 to 3 days before the actual sale. And I recognize that Judge Palaha found sufficient actual notice, but does this record establish for us when Mr. Schleining received actual notice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you disagree with his statement that it was 2 to 3 days?
I respectfully disagree with Mr. Moloff's statement. There was undisputed testimony, for instance, at the trial, that Mr. Schleining had actual notice of the default at the time of the default itself.
The default is different from the notice of default and election to sell. When did he have notice of the notice of default and election to sell being filed?
He did. According to the testimony, he did not ever have specific notice of the notice of default and election to sell being recorded. So the testimony that then, once the district court properly applied the substantial compliance doctrine, the court had to look at what was his actual notice and make factual determinations as to the nature of his actual notice, and then also make factual determinations on the lack of prejudice prong as to whether when he obtained that notice and how he obtained that notice provided prejudice or not to Mr. Schleining and his ability to protect himself or takes the steps that a guarantor would take ordinarily upon receiving notice.
So let me ask just once again, is it fair to say, as Mr. Moloff does, that his client did not learn of the notice of default and election to sell, as distinguished from the default, the notice of default and election to sell, until 2 to 3 days before the sale took place?
Your Honor, I would submit that he may not even have known about that specific notice of default and election to sell at that point. What he learned approximately 3 days before the sale was that there was going to be a sale that was taking place.
Right. Before that, he knew there had been a default, but not that the property was in foreclosure.
He knew it was not in foreclosure, although it was testified that the lender's representative at the time of the default specifically told him that there would be a foreclosure on the property. Mr. Schleining also testified that his knowledge and his experience was he was familiar with that foreclosure process, and he expected that foreclosure process to take 4 to 5 months to occur.
Okay. And your point is he didn't suffer prejudice because the note was due in full, so the 35-day opportunity to cure was meaningless anyway, because he would have had to come up with all the money.
You know, there was two ways he could have protected himself, or there's a couple ways that he could have protected himself. For instance, he could have sought an extension on the note. He, in fact, did seek an extension on the note when the note came into default. He could have tried to renegotiate his guarantee. The evidence is clear and undisputed that he did, in fact, at the time the note went into default, he tried to renegotiate his guarantee. Both of those efforts were unsuccessful. He knew that he could, theoretically, try to refinance this loan. There was testimony at the trial, though, about what the value of this property was at the time of the default. That the testimony related primarily to the financial issues and the value of the property, but there was testimony that this property had gone down from a value of $4 to $5 million to a value of $1 million at the time that this went into default. The testimony that Mr. Schleining said was he never made any serious attempt at all to refinance the property. And the court weighed the evidence and made a factual determination and credibility determination of what Mr. Schleining did and what he didn't do. For instance, when he found out about the sale that's in the evidence, what did he do? He did absolutely nothing. He didn't call to try to extend the deadline of the sale to seek an extension of the foreclosure sale. He didn't go to try to obtain a court order or file a TRO to stop the sale under the theory he didn't get notice. He didn't show up to the sale to purchase the property himself. If he had money to avoid this process, he could have shown up at the sale. And he also didn't do what the statute allows a person who doesn't get notice to do, which is 107.080 subsection 6, allows a party to come to a court to apply to a court within 120 days after learning of the sale in order to come back and try to set aside the sale. He didn't do that either. So, Your Honor, I would submit that once the substantial compliance doctrine applies with the safeguards, then the knowledge issue and the compliance issue and the prejudice issue are factual determinations for the court to make.
And it's a clearly erroneous standard in your mind.
A clearly erroneous standard, and also in the Las Vegas plywood case, Your Honors, this court held that the determination of substantial compliance is reviewed for abuse of discretion. And therefore, because substantial compliance doctrine applies, and I will touch upon that briefly, because then the court, the trier of fact, has to evaluate these issues of what is the notice, when was the notice, was there substantial compliance, was there lack of prejudice, that this court should defer to those factual findings by the district court who took the evidence, heard the testimony, had to weigh the credibility of the evidence. For instance, Mr. Schleining made statements at trial, which I would submit were self-serving and unsupported, that if I had only had some more time or a specific time window, then I would have been able to take care of this. But that was contrary to the other evidence about the fact that he couldn't renegotiate the loan. He couldn't find funding when he looked for it. He apparently didn't have the funding to pay it off himself. He couldn't renegotiate his guarantee, and he took specific steps to try to do that. So those are all factual determinations that the court made in weighing the evidence on lack of prejudice. Now, if I may address the issue of substantial compliance briefly, Your Honors, this court has repeatedly held that where the language of a statute is plain and unambiguous, and its meaning is clear and unmistakable, there is no room for construction, and the courts are not permitted to search for its meaning beyond the statute itself. That's a quote from the Lowe case, which is cited in the briefs, although it's the standard. If the language is clear, this court does not look at what is the statutory intent, what is the public policy, et cetera. I would submit that the language of NRS 107.080 is clear and express in that it expressly allows substantial compliance. If the court looks at subsection 5 of NRS 107.080, as it existed at the time, and it's been modified slightly since then, but it's still, this language applies. Subsection 5 talks about when a court may set aside a sale for failure of notice. Subsection 5 says, a sale made pursuant to this section may be declared void by any court of competent jurisdiction in the county where the sale took place if, subsection A, the trustee or other person authorized to make the sale does not, substantially comply with the provisions of this section. So to the extent that there is a question as to whether strict compliance is necessary versus substantial compliance, I would submit that the plain language of the statute expressly allows substantial compliance and expressly allows the district court to make the determination of substantial
compliance. But significantly, subsection 5, as written in the relevant time, does not cross-reference 095. It cross-references 086 and 087. That gave me pause when I was reading this on your substantial compliance argument.
Your Honor, I think subsection 5 talks about every sale made under the provisions of this section and other sections of this chapter vests the purchaser the title of the grantor. And at least as the statute was in effect at the time, which is in our appendix, it does not specifically reference the other statutes. It talks about the notice, the provisions of this section. The trustee or other person authorized to make the sale does not substantially comply with the provisions of this section. This section would be NRS 107.080, which would include the notice provision of subsection 3 of NRS 107.080, and that is the specific section that's consolidated or cross-referenced into the 107.095 statute. And I would note, Your Honors, too, that that section 5 has been changed by the legislature since this time. The legislature, the current statute says that the sale must be set aside, but it still uses a substantial compliance language in there. So it's clear that the legislative intent is that the substantial compliance doctrine applies to the notice in subsection 3 of NRS 107.080, which is incorporated into NRS 107.095.
Are you conceding that the waiver of the notice provisions was invalid? And if not, could you make your argument for why that waiver should be upheld?
I am not conceding that, Your Honor. As the court knows, the district court made a finding on a motion for summary judgment on that issue. I believe that finding was in error. As the court is aware, NRS 40.453 drives a very broad, unlimited waiver of rights under the statutes. This court has addressed that standard in the low case. And in the low case, the court looked at it and made the determination that it can't possibly mean what it says, that it would lead to absurd results because it would waive, in the low case, it was a jury waiver, but arbitration clauses and other rights. And
did you cross appeal on that, Mr. Georgeson, on that ruling from the district court that Judge Palaha made?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Did you file a cross appeal?
I originally filed a cross appeal, and I think the cross appeal was later dismissed procedurally, but it was included in our brief.
Okay.
Procedurally, I think, I can't recall exactly what the situation was. I originally did file a cross appeal on that issue.
But you're defending the correctness of a judgment in your favor?
On that basis, yes, yeah. As an alternative basis.
Okay.
So if I may, Your Honor, in Lowe, the court said essentially that the waiver can't include all waivers, and therefore the waiver is limited to the anti-deficiency statutes. And so the anti-deficiency statutes, the court looked at the legislative history because it did so because it found an ambiguity, and the legislative history was that the anti-deficiency statutes were in NRS 40.451 through 40.459. And those, of course, are the rights that the grantor and the guarantor has to have a court determination of the value of the deficiency, which is, of course, the underlying trial that we had in this case. The notice statute at issue here in NRS 107.080 and 095 are clearly not in Chapter 40, and I would submit are not part of those anti-deficiency statutes. And I would submit that the rationale applies there, because even if that guarantor waives notice of the default, then the statute to the legislative intent and the policy is he still gets the trial on the guarantee. He still gets the trial pursuant to the Chapter 40 anti-deficiency statutes. And so a guarantor, I would submit, can then waive the notice of default, service of notice of default requirements. That portion is waived, but the guarantor cannot waive the anti-deficiency statutes that are in Chapter 40. And then, Your Honor, I would note that in the McDonald case, and the McDonald case was a slightly different set of facts, but the McDonald case was after the Lowe case, after the court had already identified what the anti-deficiency statutes were and what can be waived. This court noted that the fact that McDonald waived his right as a guarantor to notice of default by the principal debtor does not make an NRS 40.430, and that was the one action rule statute, inapplicable. The court also said if the guarantor waived notice under 107.095 subsection 1, which is the exact statute we're talking about here, the notice is also waived under the one action rule statute. Your Honor, I would submit that although the facts are slightly different, this court has specifically recognized in McDonald after the Lowe that the waiver in NRS 107.095 subsection 1 is valid, because otherwise the court would have to either, I would respectfully submit, overrule itself in McDonald or retract that statement. My time is up.
Thank you very much.
I have a question before you start.
Okay, Judge.
Justice Gibbons raised the issue that the cross-appeal is not existent. Does the respondent have a right to defend the judgment on the basis of that the waiver was wrong, the ruling of Judge Palau was wrong, without the cross-appeal?
I believe procedurally that the respondent does have the right to raise that issue. We disagree with the conclusions, obviously, but I do believe procedural aspects of this appeal that he is allowed to raise that issue.
Tell me why.
As much as I'd like to.
Tell me why. I'm just curious at this. I there's no cross appeal on that issue. It's the law of the case as far as the district court's concerned. I'm just curious as to the procedure.
I'm not really sure about the analysis of that, other than since they won, they're the respondent, they can seek to raise that issue, I guess. I really I'm not able to address that in all candor. But what I would like to address is the fact that the waiver argument doesn't get the court to where the respondent would like to be. Yes, Section 440.453 is a very broad statute, and the Lowe case did, in fact, limit that statute with regards to the rights to a trial by jury. But it went out of its way in Lowe to point out that statutes relating to deficiency judgments are certainly included. And it's very interesting. Chapter 40 incorporates, as I'm sure the court knows, lots of different areas of the law. One of the areas, there's a subsection which is entitled Foreclosure Sales and Deficiency Judgments. It's foreclosure sales and deficiency judgments under which 40.453 exists. This, you can't have a waiver. To argue that somehow 107.095 is separate from the deficiency judgment statutes is a false argument. Obviously,
what about the McDonald case that Mr. Georgeson's talking about?
The McDonald case is very misleading. It's a very confusing case to understand. But one thing is clear about the McDonald case. It didn't address 40.453. That wasn't an issue before the court in 45.3. It was interpreting whether 3 days, what kind of notice was required for the three-day notice of non-responsibility by an owner or lessor of real property when a mechanics lien, potential mechanics lien claimant has filed a pre-lien notice. In that statute, the 3 days is triggered by actual notice in that statute. It's not triggered necessarily only by the pre-lien notice. It's a three-day quick turnaround kind of statute. The mechanics lien statutes are a remedial set of statutes, which this court has said are to be applied liberally to protect the rights of contractors, whereas the foreclosure statutes, particularly Section Chapter 107, the non-judicial foreclosure statutes were a result of wanting to get lenders to lend more money to simplify the foreclosure process. That was the public policy. The trade-off for letting lenders have non-judicial foreclosure sales, not to be subject to the rights of redemption or to be subject to having to go through a trial and so forth, the trade-off, the legislative trade-off, was to give guarantors and borrowers about 4 months to protect their interests. And those statutes, I believe the judicial and legislative intent was to be remedial, to protect borrowers and guarantors, not to protect mechanics lien claimants like the mechanics lien claimant statute, the mechanics lien statutes are meant to do.
Counsel, you raised the lack of timely notice, the 91 days, and indicated the client only got 3 days. In response, the other side has indicated that there was a failure to take advantage of the provision that allows 120 days to set aside. Why is that not sufficient to cure the prejudice, and was it argued below?
I don't think that was argued below, but in this case, you still have to give notice. To have substantial compliance, I want to correct one thing that I may have left a misunderstanding in response to one of Justice Pickering's questions. Yes, actual notice can be substantial compliance, but only if there's at least an attempt to give the notice required. There has to be some compliance with that notice provision. There can't be none, zero, zilch like there was in this case. There was none in this case. And despite the fact that the address went to the same address that the business had, DeKalb Nevada had, the undisputed evidence was that Mr. Schleining's office was 300 miles away. He never went to that office. That his partner that ran that office had forwarded all the mail
to him. Mr. Moloff, if I may, finding 45 on page 7 of the judge's order makes reference to an admission number 17, which I assume is a request for admission response. And it says, without reference to the date on which your client acquired actual knowledge, that before the foreclosure sale, your client had actual knowledge that the foreclosure sale was scheduled to take place on June 11, 2008. Was there anything else with regard to that admission that qualified it in any way?
To my knowledge, and in all candor, I haven't reviewed that, but in my understanding, the only evidence, there was two pieces of evidence, and they're in the record. One is that he only learned of the foreclosure 2 to 3 days before the sale took place, and there was a question asked of him, did you learn before May 15th? And his answer was, no, I didn't know before May 15th. And then the question was, when did you know 2 to 3 days beforehand? So the only evidence in the record is that he knew 2 to 3 days beforehand. I realize my time is up, but I would say this, that if the court affirms the district court's decision, it will render 107.095 basically meaningless, because in this case there was not even any attempt to comply with that statute. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank both counsel for excellent briefs and arguments, and also commend you on attaching the versions of the statutes that were then in place to your briefs. That's very helpful. We'll be in recess for 15 minutes.